FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's the last day of February in 2019. Markets behaving in a very interesting fashion. Looks like our recent peak in the Dow, well, that could be history soon. I mean, it hit 26,000, pulled back. You got a thought about the markets or you want to hear ours? Just email us, kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, you probably all are familiar with the Jussie Smollett case, that racial hoax, supposed lynching that Mr. Smollett, I don't even know who he is, really some actor on Empire, which I've never seen, said that he was attacked by a couple of people in sub-zero weather in New York, wearing MAGA hats. I don't know when the last time he saw someone in Chicago wearing a MAGA hat, probably never, attacked him in the middle of the night, and the cops instantly unraveled it. It was a hoax. It was picked up by all the media, and they have an agenda here, obviously. Well, finally, there is an academic study about racial hoaxes, and evidently it's far more widespread than you would have ever imagined. And Dr. Will Riley is with us now, African-American professor of political science at Kentucky State University. So he obviously doesn't have an axe to grind here. And we're really thrilled to have him on. Professor, what is it with these hoaxes? Why are they happening?
Well, there's a lot there. So first of all, thanks for the intro. And yeah, the fact that I'm a middle-class black guy at one of the better black colleges does make it harder, hopefully, to call me a Nazi. I guess we'll see.
But no, you're a racist. Here.
First of all, the pitch line for the book itself is remarkably simple. Over the past 4 to 5 years, many, if not most, of the most widely reported high-profile, quote-unquote, hate crime stories, say top 50 in Google search results, have turned out to be fakes. So that list includes, obviously, Jussie Smollett. That's a story that we literally just watched collapse in real time. That includes, I think you'd have to say, Covington Catholic the week before that, where
absolutely,
the allegation was that this group of prep school athletes, they surrounded this literally a Native American Indian elder. They threatened to take his people's sacred rain drum. They chanted build the wall. That never happened. There's a document on YouTube that it never happened. Yasmin Saweed, the young girl who claimed that she was attacked on a train by hijab-ripping Trump supporters, Eastern Michigan, the multiple graffiti incidents, Air Force Academy, where a general had to come to the campus and say racism is bad before the truth came out. The young black girl pre-college who claimed that boorish white men literally urinated on her. Key in college, the list of death threats, Wisconsin Parkside, the nooses all over the campus. And this really just goes on and on. I mean, the UVA rape, which made the front cover of Rolling Stone. The claim was that the fraternities were running anti-feminist rape rings at an ACC school, top 50 school. Duke lacrosse, obviously, the OG, where the claim was that a good chunk of a lacrosse team had, within a two-minute period, sexually abused a female stripper and escort. All of these cases collapsed. They all turned out to be hoaxes. And I have a legal background. I have a law degree from Illinois that I picked up in 2005. So it's rare that you see a 30-40% of a category of crime turn out to be just fake. So I began to research this from an academic qualitative perspective and ask why. And that's what produced the book, which is a hate crime hoax out with Regnery.
Yeah, which you've really done a service. And the book, it's a scholarly work. It's on Regnery, which we interview a lot of Regnery authors. And yeah, when you go back, it goes back to Tawana Brawley. She was kind of the original race hoaxer. And again, the book is Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. So it started with Tawana Brawley, and then somehow Al Sharpton, one of the perpetrators of that fraud, is now a respected leader in the African-American community. He should have been banished for life. The other two attorneys who were involved there, who I happen to have known one of them, he stuck me on a bill just as a coincidence, just as a sidebar. Both of them were disbarred. C. Vernon Mason, and I can't remember the other guy's name, but they at least...
Elton Maddox.
Elton Maddox. They were both driven out of the profession, which they rightly should have been. But from that point on, Al Sharpton's star rose dramatically, where he's a reputable... respected leader of the African-American community, at least as far as the Democratic Party and MSNBC are concerned. Does that disturb you, Dr. Riley?
Well, I think there are two levels there. So first of all, I'm glad you added that last line. I think that the majority of actual members of minority groups, if you want to use that label, in America, I'm not a big hyphen fan myself, but Asians, middle class blacks, Jews, are normal people that are doing quite well. I mean, all three groups I just mentioned earn more than the national average. It's a long time since 1954. I think that on the extreme left, you see a lot of people arguing that they are the true friends and supporters of minority Americans. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think the idea on the left fringe of the Democratic Party is that minorities would be useful allies in bringing about their real goal, which is socialism. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many black Americans, much less Asian Americans, actually believe that. I mean, you do sometimes see black Democratic voting in the black community, which is a problem. We can discuss why that is. But I mean, I would bet that a very large percentage of the donations to Al Sharpton's National Action Network, for example, come from white lefties concentrated on the coast. I would lay money on that. So I don't know how respected Al Sharpton is in the average barbershop, but you're absolutely right. That is an illustration of some of the double standards that we see in our society. I mean, Al Sharpton obviously was an advocate for, you're referring to the insane Tawana Brawley race hoax in the late 1980s.
Exactly.
Where... yeah, a young woman. And the thing about a lot of these stories is they're so unbelievable. But as a middle class business person, especially a white one, although I am not, you're not supposed to discuss them at all, but they're crazy. Tawana Brawley claimed she'd been kidnapped from her house for 4 days and she'd been taken to the woods. Now, this is New York City in the 80s. I don't know where the woods would have been.
It was Dutchess County, a little further north of New York City. But yeah, go on. So she was taken to the woods.
Yeah. She was taken to the woods, and there she was abused by a series of men. This was sexual, vaginal, anal. This is brutal. Words were written on her body. But one of the men was apparently a uniformed New York City police officer. She claimed that one of the men was the district attorney, either of King County, which is Brooklyn, or of Dutchess Pagones.
Pagones.
So she literally
yes.
claimed she was driven to the woods by the district attorney and sexually abused for days. And this is, no one was supposed to say that this was crazy. And Al Sharpton, who at the time was kind of a flamboyant guy, he had a perm. He was working out of an office, I believe, next to between a barbershop and a tax preparer. He showed up and he said that he was going to represent Tawana Brawley and he was going to get justice from the white man. And this case became a circus. Of course, eventually all charges were dismissed at Fondland law schools. And the unusual step of completely disbarring, Esquires Mason and Maddox was taken. But Al Sharpton, somehow, you're right, he didn't fall from grace after that. And there's a lot about Al Sharpton, again, speaking as a black guy who's not really a fan of this style of black leadership. That, I mean, Al Sharpton was an FBI informant for a while, allegedly. Mm-hmm. There's a tape of him that Brian Gumbel hilariously played on Real Sports. He, like me, is a black guy with a tie, not a big fan of Reverend Al. But yeah. Where Al Sharpton talks about buying cocaine and delivering that to the FBI.
I remember yes.
Escaped all that. He escaped Tawana Brawley and a bunch of other things like Freddie's Fashion Mart, where he gave a speech about how Jewish interlopers needed to be chased out of New York. So a crazy
people
guy
died.
Was high on angel dust, set one of the city's most popular men's clothing stores on fire. Uh-huh. Large group of black and white customers fled the burning building. 7 were killed. So yeah, Al has managed to escape that. And I think that's one of many illustrations of how narrative is manufactured. If you don't know the reality of many, many situations, because you're not being told the reality of many, many situations, you will believe what you are being told most of the time for most people. And this ties into the reality of a great number of hate crimes are fake, of course. This ties into the reality a great number of political leaders on both sides, especially I would say the left, are corrupt, Sharpton would be included in that group. Unless someone says these things, people aren't going to know them. So one of my goals as an academic is to actually say these things.
Yeah. Yeah. And who better than you? So, you know, when you look at all these things and Obama, you know, we had the fake racial crime when the professor in Cambridge was trying to climb through the window of his house and a Cambridge cop went up to him and didn't do anything other than ask him for ID. And this became a whole big blown out of proportion. And basically President Obama, former President Obama, said, oh, he was, a knucklehead, basically. It was a dumb. Of course, it was the cop's fault. Now, if the cop had just let him climb in there and he turned out to be a burglar and the cop just watches a burglary taking place, then he would have been. It would have been a racial crime because that was a black person's home and you let it be robbed, but you wouldn't have done that for a white person, right? I mean, that cop was in a no-win situation.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Egypt is on the verge, once again, becoming a world-renowned gold producer. The Golden Age is being rediscovered. For millennia, ancient Egyptian kingdoms prospered from unparalleled riches. Pharaohs built their empires and flaunted their abundant wealth that was made possible by the country's resource-rich gold deposits. Despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world. Aton Resources is at the center of the modern Egyptian mining world, diligently working both as the only public exploration company in Egypt today and as the advocate for mining reform with the Egyptian government. However, those that arrive early, like Aton, will reap the best rewards. Aton's discovery of the legendary lost mountain of gold at Rudruin and its current aggressive drilling program there could potentially reap those rewards. Aton Resources is focused on its 100% owned Abu Marwat concession in the Arabian-Nubian Shield, located 200 kilometers north of Sentimen Sakkari's world-class gold mine. Aton possesses first-mover advantage in the underfollowed jurisdiction of Egypt, which is currently undergoing mining reform. To stay on top of Aton's latest drill results and news, go to AtonResources.com. Aton trades on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the ticker AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Yeah, cops have a tough job these days. I actually think Barack Obama said some stupid things about that, like the cop acted stupidly, acted like a fool, is a quote. Mm. I do think his actual solution was pretty elegant. He had the two guys meet for a beer, and they all sat in the White House lawn and had three or four beers. So, I mean, I would have gone to that meeting. But, yeah, essentially in that situation, I think you're kind of leading into a broader issue, which is the presentation. There's a lot there, actually. So, first of all, one of the major arguments the activist left has to make, because policies like affirmative action, minority set-asides, the budgets for activist groups like the STLC depend on it, is that the USA is still an extraordinarily racist country. I don't personally find that to be true. Obviously, there are individual bigots, and I think that most normal people in American, whatever, middle or upper middle class life are fairly unified in opposing them. I think you are. I think I am. Most people are. Yeah. So that still exists to some extent. But I mean, to be realistic, the USA desegregated in 1954. And at that point, you're talking pretty much about the South desegregating. The major northern cities, except for restrictive covenants in individual neighborhoods, including well-off black ones, by the way. But the North had desegregated about 1926. Civil Rights Act, 1965, made racism criminally and civilly illegal. Again, I'm not arguing any of these things were perfect solutions, but it's just stupid to deny that they existed. My favorite, actually, affirmative action has been the law of the land since the Philadelphia plan in 1967 under Mr. Nixon. So, I mean, we've had 52 years, not just of rough equity, but of affirmative action. And this is a major force. And this is another thing that's just not discussed. When I applied to law schools, I had become aware, bluntly, I dated someone who worked in a college admissions office. I'd become aware in undergrad school that the average gap between blacks and whites in terms of SAT, where I went to school, which is the Big Ten, I went to University of Illinois, was about 200 to 300 SAT points, which is an enormous gap. And when I applied to law school, I was aware that I would get into most of the law schools I applied to. But since I was very good, I didn't want to finish at the bottom of my class. So I looked at where my LSAT score, which is a 169, would be a little above average. And I ended up going to, again, University of Illinois. But I mean, the reality that if you're a black dude with standard good marks, you can go to Harvard is kind of a counter to the idea that this is one of the most racist countries in the world, blah, blah, blah. Right. But anyway, the point of all this is that racism has to be emphasized because the argument for programs like minority set aside is still nothing has changed. America is still the place it was. And that leads to a lot of odd behavior. And one of the odd behaviors is the redefining of what racism is. So racism, you know, perception of weakness of blood, that's a quote from, I believe, Genghis Khan. It's one of the old leaders, is one of the oldest human vices. It's not even necessarily a vice in all situations. It's the idea that you dislike people that have a different skin color or tribal appearance from you. That's what racism has always been. And now there's very little of that in the USA, at least publicly expressed where it matters. If you asked a bunch of guys on a trading floor, which was my job before academia, do you mind working with an Asian, a Jew, a black, a successful Cuban immigrant? Everyone would say no. And then guys would start making fun of you, saying things like, what are you, a bigot? So that's gone. What you have to do now, if you want to argue the country is institutionally racist, is find new weird kinds of racism. Like one that I get a kick out of is white privilege. The idea that you can't measure it, but just by virtue of being white, all my white buddies have an enormous advantage that I don't. There's cultural appropriation, which is an insane idea, which is often used to criticize blacks for things like eating tacos and taking from Hispanic culture, because Latinos have a lower average income than we do in the black community, by the way. But I mean, cultural appropriation is the idea that somehow racist to like another culture and learn from it. This police stuff, you now see the argument that police procedure is racist. So you're talking about the Skip Gates incident where this professor, who's a nice guy, by the way, I mean, Skip Gates goes to the academic conferences and so on, but he lost his keys. He was pissed off. He'd been on one of those red eye flights for 10 hours. So he did something like something his wife probably was not too crazy, but he kicked in his own dormer window and just walked into his house. And a police officer was watching this. And he went over and said, you know, hey, buddy, you can't do that. I mean, even if that's your home, you're probably not supposed to do that. And I'm not sure it's your home. So you're going to have to show me some ID. And Skip Gates was tired. And he said something like, your mama can show me some ID or something like this. It was like a comeback line. Mm-hmm. And the cop was like, look, if you say something like that again, I'm probably going to put the cuffs on you. And Gates was like, you know, bleep you. Yeah. So the cop said, OK, and arrested him for some kind of misdemeanor. I don't think either man handled it brilliantly, but there's nothing there. That's not a story. Right. It became a story because the perception was that standard police procedure is racist. Mm-hmm. And you see that a lot with a lot of these fairy tales. Like when we were talking before the show, you mentioned Mike Brown.
Right.
And yeah, that's another one where a whole narrative kind of grew up. The gentle giants, hands up, don't shoot. And I feel a little ashamed to say that as a guy in the minority community, as a former athlete myself, I mean, I kind of wondered, is this, I was irritated about it for a bit until the reality came out. And the reality was that this itself, to some extent, was a hoax. In fact, pretty much totally was a hoax. Mike Brown was a guy who the day before he got shot, if I have the dates correct, had committed a strong arm robbery.
That day, actually.
He'd walked into a,
he'd walked
into a store.
Yes.
The owner was a small Asian-American individual, I think a woman. Slapped him across the face, took a $59 box of Monte Cristos, walked out. Mm-hmm. When he encountered the police, he was walking down the middle of a road, which is never a brilliant idea, and continued doing so after he saw a cop car several blocks away. So the cops, kind of provoked, had to respond. I mean, you've got a guy in the middle of the street who's wanted for a crime. They get out, there's a scuffle. Mike Brown literally grabs the officer's gun. His prints were across the slide. They were on the trigger guard.
Correct.
The officer shoots him a couple of times. Mike Brown falls down. That's the story. The entire presentation of that as racist is an example of narrative creation. And you see a lot of narrative creation that's designed to illustrate racism in our current society. I think the reason for that is that there's not very much real racism. That doesn't excuse actual bigots when we find them. We need to hound those guys.
Absolutely.
But what you see now is more the invention of new types of bigotry, I suppose. And the book discusses that.
All right. So, and you sound to me to be the natural heir to Thomas Sowell and I can't remember his name. I interviewed him, Walter Williams. But you're fact-based. So I got to believe that half the community or less loves you and the other half despises you and vilifies you. How does it feel to be a truth teller when nobody wants to hear the truth?
Well, that's an excellently phrased question. First, thanks for the compliment. I mean, Tom Sowell is a great man. I mean, Tom Sowell outside, if you look at followers of most of the European schools, like Austrian economics. Tom Sowell is considered to be one of the greatest social scientists produced in America.
Absolutely.
His issue in America has largely been that one of the things he's researched, and it wasn't his focus. I mean, I know Tom Sowell for books like Basic Economics, Economic Questions, you know, Black Rednecks and White Liberals, which goes well beyond race. Are Jews generic, for example, is the title of an essay. But I mean, one of the things Tom Sowell researched happened to be race, and he said some taboo things. For example, he said that there were IQ differences between ethnic groups, but that they didn't seem to have much of anything to do with genetics. There might be some 2 or 3 point genetic differences. He didn't think there were, but that you found similar IQ gaps anywhere you had entrenched working class culture. So he pointed out that there's a gap similar to what used to exist between blacks and whites, between Britons and many Irishmen or Scotsmen, for example. But simply mentioning something like the idea different groups can differ in currently tested mental ability, not genetic mental ability or athletic ability, which I think is evident to many people.
Sure.
That was very, very taboo in America in the late 1980s, mid-1990s. So he had a lot of backlash here. I don't think elsewhere. But you asked, how does it feel for me? I actually, one thing that I do find hilarious is that black colleges are not very politically correct. I mean, our president, M. Christopher Brown, I'm not going to speculate on his political party, but is a well-known business guy, suit pretty much every day, hosted a major country concert here for our donors. There's a lot less of the squalling that you hear in primarily white institutions. I mean, I think our campus cops, who are well-trained 200-pound African-American guys, would pretty quickly disperse a violent student protest. So African-American colleges tend to be middle to upper middle class and very gentlemanly. I mean, ours is located in the Kentucky State Capitol. Men can't be in women's dorms after 8 p.m., this kind of thing.
Good policy.
This, again, gets back to a particular point, which is that obviously African-Americans tend to be black Democratic voters, which I find problematic. But minorities in general, Jamaicans, Asians, Israelis, if you want to count Jews as a minority group, Mexicans, are not extraordinarily culturally liberal. Extremist cultural liberalism seems to be concentrated among upper middle class white people. Like, I'm thinking of hippie girls with feathers in their hair. So if you look at these massive marches on college campuses, they're some of the whitest things that you'll ever see. Go to a Bernie Sanders rally sometime.
Thanks.
Well, that's pretty funny. I like keeping my money in my pocket too. But I mean, just if you think about any of that stuff, I covered Occupy Chicago for a while as a writer in grad school living in Chicago. And I mean, these are some of the most Caucasian events you'll ever observe. I obviously have no problem with Caucasians, but it is kind of funny if you go to a concert called Rock Against Racism with a white date and everyone there but you is white. And that's something you see all the time. That's a real story that I still tell. So, I mean, I think that in a black college, we don't have the guilt-based limits. And by the way, I think there's an argument for black colleges and for all boys Catholic schools and for this kind of thing. I think unless you're a natural bigot, you can interact with whoever the hell you are. I don't necessarily see why your 16-employee Chinese restaurant should have to hire whites or blacks because you're one guy over the limit. I mean, the question should be, do they know how to cook Chinese food? But that's a different question, commentary for a different day. But I think here there's a little less of that guilt. So, I mean, at K-State, men generally wear ties or jackets, at least polo shirts. There's no idea that it is racist to tell a black man he has to look like a business person to get an internship. So, and I think if I were a faculty member at a primarily white institution, I didn't have tenure, I'd probably get fired for a lot of the books I've written.
I wouldn't doubt it. And we should mention the book is Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. Just came out on February 6th. We're honored to have you on. And, well, I could go on all day with you because you're a breath of intellectual fresh air that we don't really usually get or find on college campuses anymore, but we kind of have to wrap it up. But the book is available at amazon.com and wherever fine books used to be sold, and we will definitely have you on again, Dr. Riley. It's really been a pleasure. Wish you the best of luck on this book. Hey, anybody who's interested in the book, like I said, amazon.com. You want to send us an email, I'll forward it to Dr. Riley. It's kl@carrielutz.com. Twitter feed at Carrie Lutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Dr. Riley, wish you the best of luck on this book, and we're purchasing a copy as we speak.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for doing that and for having me on the show. And again, yeah, I think you have my contact. If not, email me, text me, and this is my phone number, obviously. I'll shoot them along. But yeah, I look forward to coming back.
All right, absolutely. And we'll set aside more time. We'll spend like a couple of hours talking over these issues because I think they're so important and they're not fairly dealt with in the media, right or left media, because it becomes an us versus them. And there's a lot more to the debate than that. There are legitimate issues from the past that perhaps haven't all been addressed, need to be addressed better, but it's more important to figure out what are we going to do going ahead? How do we come together as different races, as different parties in the country? And I think your approach and what you've told me during this interview really resonates and I think is very important, needs to be out there so that people can understand it and act accordingly and change your attitudes, your beliefs, because a lot of what you think you know just isn't right. So, Dr. Riley, thank you so much again. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Sounds good. Have a great day.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.